Welcome, everyone, to Food Conversations, Season 5. The first thing we do, of course, is acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral and ceded and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepemec people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for us all. Now, today we are delighted to have in the studio someone who is highly skilled at creating food that will tickle your palate, sweeten your tongue, and delight you with exquisite flavors. Kate Boutillier, prize-winning pastry chef, a graduate of the Northwest Culinary Academy in Vancouver, and the proud owner of the brand new Flake Pastry Shop in Centinoco Mall, where you can buy her exquisite concoctions, which she creates at the Zest Food Hub and where she has become an established anchor tenant. Kate, welcome to Food Conversations.
Thank you very much, Warren. Thank you.
Delighted to have you here, Kate. Now, not like most of our guests here on the show, you spent time in a number of places in the world, including both sides of this country and several parts of Europe, living and learning your craft from leading experts and striving for, literally striving for, the pinnacle of food craftsmanship.
That's right, yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure.
Talk about the Canadian Culinary Olympics and your role in them.
Well, I was invited to become part of a team, a regional team from British Columbia, after winning my own round of competitions, which were black box competitions, meaning the sponsors usually provide a series of ingredients that are hidden from the competitors until the competition commences.
My goodness, putting you in a little stressful situation.
Yes, so it kind of forces you to think outside the box and practice a lot of skills that can be applied kind of last minute. So it was a very beneficial experience in kind of pushing my career forward in a very fast-paced way. And they held competitions regionally in Kelowna, provincially in Vancouver, and then nationals were held in Edmonton that year. And I won gold in all three, so I was...
So all three?
Yeah. What? Well, you have to win one to get to the next round.
Okay.
Like a typical competition. So,
all right.
I won gold in Kelowna, won gold in Vancouver, and then won gold in Edmonton. And that kind of afforded me an invitation onto Team Culinary British Columbia, which is... We practiced together in Vancouver at BC Place in the stadium there because our coach was the executive chef there at the time. And after we did some practicing, we were all flown to Basel, Switzerland to compete in something called chauffoir, which is called cold show. It's where everything is just perfectly done and placed and then glazed in a gelatin glaze so it shines like jewelry on these tables. And I was part of the pastry team that went to Switzerland. So we had our savory team and then we had our pastry team and I was part of the pastry team. Yeah.
This is not low-level stuff. This is stuff to keep you awake at night when you're planning or hoping to plan what you're going to do in the next day.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about another one that was also one that played a role in your life in terms of this sort of making the best that could be made. And that's called the Bocuse d'Or, which we had a little spelling bee on the on the telephone trying to get it spelt right.
Yeah.
Bocuse is the name of Paul Bocuse, who is a famous chef, in Lyon, which is the second biggest city in France. It's in the southeastern part of the country. And he was so well known that he and some colleagues who admired him greatly initiated his competition. It began in 1987. That was the first year it was held, and it's held every couple of years. And as I was reading up on it, I realized this is a bit of a wild free-for-all because you have a live audience and you cook in front of them and they're noisy. Apparently, since the Mexicans brought a mariachi band for their team, the place has gone wild every year. So talk about the Bocuse d'Or, which means, by the way, Bocuse is a guy's name and d'Or means of gold.
Yeah.
So it's a gold competition in his name.
Well, so to clarify, I've never competed or taken part in preparations for the Bocuse d'Or. I worked for a chef who did, straight out of culinary school. We do things called stage, where we go to a certain restaurant and we offer our labor for free just in order to get a tidbit of education. Or even some secrets, maybe snap some photos of a recipe book
when no one's looking.
So right out of culinary school, I wanted to set the pace for my career. I wanted to start somewhere that I could learn some real sort of proprietary skills in my field. And so I applied at a few places to stage, and the Pear Tree was my absolute top of the list.
The Pear Tree restaurant in Kelowna with
Vancouver.
Vancouver with mm-hmm. Scott Yeager.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's now closed. They ran it for a great many years with much success, an amazing reputation. And I think it was time for Scott to retire. You know, this industry has a way of riding you pretty hard.
Wearing you down quickly. You learned some important things at that restaurant.
Yes, absolutely. There was no margin for error, so I won't even say a small margin for error. Scott was incredibly discerning. He wanted perfection, and he accepted nothing less. And now, being a business owner, I understand the financial burden that really puts on the business owner. And I have a ton of respect for it, and more awe than I ever did when I was an apprentice there. But it just, you know, he would take it down to so many different degrees of what to look for when executing a recipe. Your temperatures had to be spot on. Your sizing of, you know, piping macarons would have to be absolutely perfect. We made these tiny little miniature hazelnut macarons for the side of tea service, you know. And it wasn't even something that we charged for necessarily.
Did your customers understand how hard you worked to get this stuff together? They didn't see it physically. They just saw the finished product and tasted it, of course.
Well, it was a semi-open kitchen. You could kind of see the kitchen from a certain spot of about three tables in the dining room. But for the most part, it was in the back. I think that most people out there don't quite understand the work that goes into especially creating food that has, you know, like a lot of moving parts within a recipe. Places where you can really mess it up, and at that point it's no longer what you're looking for. It's not necessarily totally garbage. Sometimes you can use things in other applications, but it's a very delicate balance creating certain recipes.
So the food that you don't use is food that isn't quite exactly right.
Mm.
Which is interesting, because of course some of these large chain McDonald's etc. restaurants, they have a time limit. They don't focus on the quality of the food so much as they focus on whether it's 20 minutes since it's been put in a warming oven, and if it's over 20 minutes, it often goes into the garbage.
Right.
Yours, you learned there not to waste food because you'd get it right so that you didn't have to.
Absolutely. And that was for selfish reasons completely, because it was time. Our time was very important. We had a lot of things to execute in our day. And if we messed one thing up, it meant you had to start all over again. And very frustrating on those days. So
I can see why people retire early.
Yeah.
They've had enough of that.
Yeah.
How did this lead to the Bocuse d'Or and your involvement, even just as part of a team, but necessarily involved with it?
Well, I came kind of on the heels of it. So Scott Yeager had just competed in the Bocuse d'Or a year before I started working for him. So his reputation was just like on fire. And of course, I wanted a piece of it. His menu at the restaurant was actually still highly influenced by the menu that he cooked in France. So very, very cool. And it was just, you know, that level of of finesse that you see in competitions like the Bocuse d'Or was directly, you know, it was palpable in his restaurant. You could see the menu, the techniques, and back at that time, you know, and I still hold on to this dream to a degree, but I wanted to be probably, well, I wanted to be the first female Canadian chef to go there and win it. Now that I have children, I don't know if that's a possibility.
There are other relevancies.
Yeah, yeah. Some of my priorities have changed, but...
Well, who knows if they're for the worse or the better, but they're better for you, and that's what really counts.
That's right. And there's no age limit to competing in the Bocuse d'Or, so there's still hope for me yet.
Initially, I understand that you had to be under 22. There was a sort of an age requirement.
For certain members of your team. So there are age requirements, actually. For your apprentices, they have to be under 22. So you... for Scott, he was looking for apprentices that really stood out, took their job extremely seriously, were very, very dedicated to their craft, and intelligent off the gate, right? Like, you couldn't really come in with just a fire in your belly. You had to really have things dialed
in. You had to know
what
you were doing.
Yeah, yeah.
So did you actually go to Lyon?
No.
Physically?
No.
You were deprived of that experience?
I was deprived of that, yeah. Scott never went back. They usually, because the amount of practice that it requires to have any level of success, the whole Culinary Confederation of Chefs in Canada will pool finances to train the team. And sometimes you will be a British Columbian chef who has an apprentice from Toronto because they just fit the bill. That's how rare, you know, a highly talented, conscientious apprentice can be in this industry sometimes. You got to fly them in from Toronto.
Well, you did cleverly plant an excuse to go to France. Your brother is working in Paris.
That's right.
In the unusual situation, by the way, I think you said about 5'2". He's about 6'6".
That's right.
There's some interesting genetic disparities going on.
I started drinking coffee at a very young age.
Well, that's the whole reason.
Yeah.
And he works as a dancer, mostly tap dancing, for Disney.
That's right.
In Paris.
Yeah.
And does some acting there.
That's right. Yeah.
So you've got a plant that will help you get over to the chocolatier we'll talk about at the end.
Yeah, I've got a place to stay if I ever want to go to
very well,
Valrhona
very well
Chocolate
planned.
School.
Just remind listeners that I'm speaking today with Caitlin de Boutillier, who is the owner and brains and work behind a new restaurant in Centinoca Mall called the Flake Pastry Shop.
That's right.
Now, the word flake has an interesting connotation, a little bit of irony there, because growing up, your mom sort of was a little skeptical about how you would do and everything. So I think she used the term flake to describe your way of doing things. And in a certain sense, I think you've kind of shown her that you're not a flake.
Yeah.
Not only with the restaurant, but with the stuff that we're going to talk about, some of the ways that you got to the point where you were at school studying. So you were born in Toronto.
That's right.
You came back to Kelowna. Your mother came back to Kelowna with you and your brother after your parents split up, and when you were about 3.
Mm-hmm.
So you're a local citizen. You went to the schools, and then you moved from Kelowna to Salmon Arm. She trained as a nurse.
Yeah, that's right.
And then you moved here, and you started to go to the usual places, you know, the Jackson School and to SAS.
I was there the last year before they tore down Jackson. We went there for grade 8. So I was lucky I got in while the getting was good.
You saw it while it was still there.
Yeah.
And then you wanted to figure out what you're going to do for the rest of your life. So part of what you ended up doing was influenced by a conversation you had with your brother on one occasion, which was an important one because it sort of It touched you deeply, the conversation where he talked to you about his frank brotherly, you may love him, but he's your brother, therefore, booze.
Yeah.
Out it comes. What was that like? And what did he say, and how did that impact on you? Because it had a big impact?
Well, as a teenager, and I think a lot of teenagers are like this, so I'm gentle with myself. But you know, we're all trying to figure out where we fit in and what we want to do. And I had a bit of a habit of starting things and not finishing them, and picking things up and then quitting them. And my brother told me, I forget exactly what it was that prompted this harsh reality that he kind of blasted me with, but he told me, Katie, you have no integrity. You don't follow through on anything you do. And it really hurt. It hurt to hear it, because I think in a way I definitely knew it to be true,
at least at that time
in my life. And it became something that I really wanted to work on. You know, I don't like it when people treat me that way. It wasn't always with the way I treated people, but it was the things I decided to do. And I decided that I wanted to have a bit more follow through with the things I was putting my interests towards, because I wasn't really sticking with anything.
But part of that was because you weren't sure yet.
Well, that's true as well. I was young. I think when he told me this, I was 16.
For all those teenagers out there, I want you all to know that not knowing exactly what you want to do in your life is okay.
Yeah.
Because you finally make your mind up and then you can apply yourself.
That's right.
So you liked cooking, and you also worked at the brew pub.
That's right. Yeah, I served at the Barley Station.
Out of this, some things came that you didn't want to do and some things that you thought you would like to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was serving at the time. And I wanted something that I considered more of a career. When I did end up moving to Vancouver and going to culinary school, which is what I had decided on, I realized that being a server is absolutely a career and absolutely a skill. I think I had the wrong maybe mindset looking at it. And quite frankly, they make a bit more money than cooks. So maybe I made a bad judgment call, but no, I...
But you've also made it clear listeners will understand this, that doing things right and doing things well is your real goal.
Yeah, I believe that's what I wanted. I wanted something, a life skill that nobody could take from me. Something that I learned, and once I had learned it, it was mine. Nobody else owned it. And I definitely had an interest in baking. I was going to the Okanagan College at the time and trying to figure out what I wanted to do, and I came to my mom and I said, oh, these midterms, they're just so stressful. I haven't even had time to bake a loaf of bread in over a week. And at that point, I had kind of realized what was important to me.
The light went on.
Yeah. You know, I like this. I'm good at it. People do this for a living, so let's think about where I can take it, you know?
And that's when another person who came into your life who was important, and that was Rod Butters. And how did things work out between you? He was obviously had a sense in directing you.
Absolutely. So in the culinary field, we adhere to Red Seal standards. So same as welders and electricians and all of that kind of, all those tradesmen were considered a trade. A friend's father once said that culinary is very different because it's somehow a trade, a science, and an art all at the same time. And I really liked that. I thought that was
interesting. I think that's pretty good.
Yeah. But so in the Red Seal program, you have a mentor when you're an apprentice. Somebody actually signs your paperwork and they take accountability for the progression of your career in the few short years while you're learning. So Rod Butters was my, and still is my mentor. I talk to him all the time about business issues and what I need to be looking for and how I need to advocate for myself. So I originally wanted to take place in a competition. So that was an interest of mine even before I went to culinary school.
What was it about the competition that drew you?
Oh, I don't know. I just think it would be fun. I think it's fun kind of throwing your hat in the ring, putting your neck on a chopping block and seeing how you measure. I think it's stressful,
not
but fun.
Literally, listeners, not literally. So he gave you some sense of direction. Was he the one who suggested that particular culinary college to go to?
No, he just said, go to culinary school and call me when you're done. Yeah. Yeah. And For some reason, I didn't see that Kelowna itself had a culinary program at the Okanagan College. I think I must have been, you know, acutely focused on Vancouver. I really wanted to move there. My brother had gone to Capilano College, and visiting him there, it's such a beautiful city, and it's got great food culture. And it exposes you to a ton of ingredients that you might not necessarily see in Kelowna or Kamloops, which are both fantastic schools. And I have a lot of colleagues that I respect very highly that have gone to both, the Thompson Rivers program and the Okanagan College program. But I went to the Northwest Culinary Academy of Vancouver. It was a small school that had just opened. The two teachers used to be the head instructors at De Brule, which is now the Vancouver Art Industry Institute. So they kind of decided, well, we're gonna leave. We're gonna do our own thing. Are we gonna do a restaurant? Or are we gonna do a school? And so they got accredited. They opened a school, very small. It only took 20 students per semester, so it was very intimate. And yeah, I think I absolutely made the right choice. I love it there.
I've noticed something about the world of chefs and culinary activities of one sort, and that is that individual people get to be known. It's a world in which if you have achieved a certain status, people get to know you. It's much more personal than some other kinds of fields where, you know, you learn carpentry, it's mostly about the technique. But when you learn to cook, you learn from people who have shown this, maybe this multiplicity of skills, you know, technique, art, passion, etc.
That's right. Well, I don't know if it maybe comes with the territory of the fact that, you know, talented chefs usually go on to either open their own restaurant or are funded to kind of be the creative force behind a restaurant. We have the ability to write books that can reach a wider audience than a lot of our other counterparts in trades.
They're said to be the best-selling class of book in the world.
Well, the photography alone in cookbooks, I mean, people call it food porn for a reason. We like to look at it, right? It's beautiful. So, that's another aspect of it being that art, right?
Well, Rod Butters, I looked up a little bit of his background, and he started his big start was in the Wiccaninish in Tofino. Mm-hmm. And at the time, it was very much a byway. Nobody really went there for the food. Mm. But his expertise and his drive really turned it into quite a special place. It started to win accolades and be listed in various places.
That's right.
And then he came to Kelowna, and his work in a couple of restaurants, first Fresco, mm-hmm. and then after that, the spelling of his other restaurant is interesting, Rod's Regional Table, but it's R, capital R-A-U, capital D, capital Z.
Yes. Well, that's for his business partner, Audrey. So
yes.
They're a team, and so it's a bit of a mixture of their first names.
And it was not the first, but one of the first farm-to-table kinds of restaurants.
That's right.
Which was also a unique feature that has captured public imagination, and he's written books about how he did that and what the principles are behind that.
That's right.
So that's something that's also a big thing in the food world. How do you create food that, in this case, addresses the climate change problem because you don't have to ship stuff from 5,000 kilometers away?
Well,
no, sometimes
right.
you do.
Yeah.
If you have a rare ingredient.
Yeah.
We don't grow cinnamon here, do we?
That's right. Yeah.
So you went to the college, and in that time, that was where you also had a connection with a pear tree restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
So how did they work together, those two places in your life?
Well, I went to the pear tree until, you know, I couldn't really afford Vancouver anymore as an apprentice in what I was doing. You know, I wasn't very skilled from out of culinary school. I had basics.
They were very, very focused on learning the basics.
The basics, because once you lay a proper foundation, you can really grow off of it. But if you have this rocky kind of crumbling foundation, everything you put on it is just going to fail. So they focused on the basics of enriched doughs and non-enriched doughs and butchery and basic seafood cutting, sauce work, very classic sauce work, our five mother sauces.
What are the five mother sauces?
Oh, man,
for our
you're
listeners.
Do it to me. It's demi-glace, bechamel, mornay, tomato sauce is actually a mother. And then hollandaise. Oh my God, I did it.
Well done. Congrats. You passed this competition with flying colors. None of us in the studio would have been able to say a thing about that at all.
And mornay is cheese sauce for the layman out there.
Yes, all of you lay people out there. That's pretty much our whole audience.
That's right.
I'll just remind listeners, I'm talking with Kate Poutillier, who is the prize-winning pastry chef and the owner and chief cook and bottle washer. That's not that doesn't get do justice to you at all. Of a new restaurant called the Flake Pastry Shop in Santanaka Mall.
That's right.
So there you are. You went from the college to Pear Tree. And what was the difference between those two?
Well, Rod's Regional Table was opened right around that 2008 downturn in the marketplace. We were in a bit of a recession, and there wasn't a huge place in the market for this white tablecloth, polished silverware, bottle service type of restaurant. There still was, but it wasn't attainable for a lot of people. So Chef decided that he wanted to kind of find something that was more approachable, but still really high quality food. He looked around for a place to put this restaurant, and he couldn't find anything better than what he already had. So they closed down Fresco's, and they renovated it into Rod's Regional Table and hired an opening team. I think I came about 6 months, maybe 9 months after it had opened, so I was still sort of opening team, and it was the same quality. I remember the standards were incredibly high, pressure was very high. The standard of ingredients was absolutely the very same as Fresco's, just kind of more like relaxed service, maybe slightly larger portions. Some plates to share, and of course the restaurant features that beautiful 20-foot farm table.
Yes, I read about that. That was quite a visual feature.
It's all
restaurant.
One piece. It's gorgeous, and they seat people right at it, right next to each other. You got to get comfortable with your neighbor, and no elbows. But it's a beautiful restaurant where it takes kind of a level of pretentiousness out of the service. Of
more down to earth.
That's right. But the quality was still the same. In fact, a lot of the dishes that were at Fresco's were very, very lightly tweaked and put right onto the menu at Rod's. I think they still have their oat-crested arc.
They even do things like preserving food from the summer to be served in sauces and various other forms in the winter.
Big time. Summer was like it was beautiful, but it was stressful. We would get in so much product that we had to build a second freezer, and we would get full pallets of raspberries from local farms, and we would use a ton of them in our menu, but we would create jams, pâte à fouille, we would can them, we made this beautiful blackberry ketchup. It was so good.
Blackberry ketchup.
Yeah.
It sounds like something quite special. I'm sure all our listeners can hear the kind of enthusiasm, engagement when you're talking about this kind of situation. But there's another side of this world, the world of working in restaurants and food, cooking and preparing and all the elaborate work that goes on. And it's sort of disparities. There's a little bit of a wellspring of misogyny, just the way women are treated in the food restaurant business is a little different from the way men are treated. Why don't you talk about that a bit? Because it's something everybody should know about.
Yeah, I mean, it always baffled me a little bit because we have this culture of believing that women and mothers need to be the caretakers of everybody's meals and the curators of the whole culinary experience at home. And yet in the industry, women, and particularly young women who hadn't been like hardened by this industry, were kind of belittled, not taken seriously. I saw it a lot. I saw it towards myself. Mistakes that were made were human, right? But I find that the mistakes of women and girls in this industry, because a lot of us get into it very young. I started when I was 18. They're put under this microscope, and they become part of your identity as a cook. And like, these mistakes aren't let go.
Somebody makes a big fuss about them.
Yeah. And it's remembered forever. Whereas, you know, the men in the industry, I find that it's kind of like, oh, it's okay, man. Like, we all make mistakes.
Don't worry, bro.
Yeah.
We're in this together.
There is a bit of bro culture, for sure. And I think that stems from the high amount of stress that comes at the cooks. You know, it's not just hard on women. It's certainly hard on a lot of people in that industry, but the camaraderie needs to be there in order to get yourself through the day. And typically, because women are outnumbered in this industry, they aren't always included in that camaraderie. But they're definitely not spared the shame of an expensive mistake or a silly mistake or something that costs us time and energy. So it was really frustrating living in that kind of status quo. And, you know, to be honest, it was something that it was either like you get on board with the boys and you become part of that team.
Sort of play the game.
Play the game or get pushed out. And it was really unfortunate because a lot of women were pitted against each other as well. And I think, like, in my experience watching the people that I worked with, you know, that sexism permeated everybody's mindset in the kitchen. Until I started to see it a lot more, and then I just realized that it was completely unfair, and I didn't want to support that type of behavior.
So how did that affect you in terms of what you wanted to do next? Where you wanted to go with your relationship to the culinary world?
Oh, well, first and foremost, I wanted to support other women that were coming into the kitchen. I wanted them to know that they weren't alone, that their passion was welcome, and it should be fostered and taken care of. And you know, we all make mistakes. We're human. And food is wildly inconsistent from season to season. This is why we put the year on a bottle of wine. So it's not always the cook. Sometimes you have a recipe and it's perfectly dialed, but the acidity of those berries is way higher than what you started with. So you need to adjust your sugar. And it's not like you don't need to attach your ego to it. It's, you know, we're all just trying to learn and do our best by what Mother Nature gives us.
I have the impression that kind of a, what do you call it, whether you call it a woman's perspective or a feminine perspective, I'm not talking about sort of social stereotypes, but about the way women often go around about doing things, which is in groups, with collaboration, not excluding people and firing them away, but sort of bring them in, trying to help them improve whatever they're doing if there's a problem, or respecting them for what they do if they're good at something. Mm-hmm. It's a little different from the sort of somewhat disruptive, sometimes aggressive, sometimes abrasive pattern that is more common in sort of male behaviors. This kind of, I'm not going to admit that I'm got any problems, you know, you got the problem, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is that something that, it almost sounds like that's something you want to foster in the work you're doing now?
Absolutely. I think that vulnerability is strength, right? When we admit that we don't understand something completely, we give ourselves an opportunity to share knowledge and all grow from that knowledge. If I know something or a way of doing something that can benefit another cook or chef, then I want that energy and that expertise to be shared amongst, you know, I would want it for myself, and I would certainly want it for any apprentice that comes on to work with me in my kitchen. I always say that, you know, this industry can't necessarily make you rich, especially not if you're doing it right, but it can give you skills that, you know, like the skills that I have taken from the people I did my apprenticeship with now have given me an opportunity to feed my family, right? To pay my mortgage.
Probably and feed them pretty well, well, in terms of the quality.
My son has gotten very entitled with croissants. He just, they're not even special to him anymore.
He's a croissant-ophile.
Yes, he is.
He's got to have his croissant. Just remind listeners that I'm having a very enjoyable conversation with Kate Boutillier, who is a prize-winning pastry chef, and is now the proud owner of a new restaurant, a pastry shop, rather, in Centinoka Mall called the Flake Pastry Shop. So at this point in your career, you'd been doing a variety of things in the culinary and food industry, and you were starting to think this is not really turning out to be what I really want to do in the long run. So you made some changes. At this point, you had two children, and you wanted to do something different that was a little more fulfilling, perhaps, and less of an overburden of stress and pressure and that kind of thing. So what did you do? You're back in this part of the world.
Well, when I came back in this part of the world, I only had the one child, my son, my first son. And I was very quickly realizing as a young mother that this industry was not going to work for me and my family. You know, I was a single mother at the time. And so I needed daycare, and daycares run for the most part 9 to 5. So I started working in like the private sector, not at restaurants.
You worked in a rehab clinic.
Yeah, I was the chef at Options Okanagan while it was still here in Salmon Arm. It now runs in Kelowna. And it was very dear to my heart because I love nurturing and caring for people. So I got really lucky with that job because it fed my soul in a totally different way. Rather than, you know, I love pastry work because you take these very kind of separate and somewhat boring ingredients like flour and sugar and, you know, an egg is really quite a transcendent ingredient on its own. But
indeed.
You know, you mix them together and you make something really, really unique and different. And the method in which you mix them makes something really unique and different. So I love that because it gives me this sense of wonder with working with food, the things that nature gives us.
There's a lot of chemistry in food.
It is, especially in French patisserie. Sugar work is crazy. It's like, I know now when I was working as a savory cook why all the savory cooks were like, pastry chefs are insane. Because we will look into a pot to find any little specks of something left behind. We will smell cutting boards. You know, we need to know that everything is just so, because if you set your caramel onto a cutting board with a frame that's, you know, smells like onions, well, now you have onion caramel. And that is not pleasant.
Unless you really ask for onion caramel,
yeah.
Which could be your new product line.
Sometimes, you know, with a nice charred steak, that doesn't sound so bad. But anyway, so I love that whole aspect of my job really brings me like a lot of joy. But I think first, before I ever found joy in executing recipes and working with ingredients, I liked to nurture. I liked to feed people and care for them. That's how I show my love.
Mm. It's a very, very ancient way of doing things. I think it goes right to the soul of humanity to have that kind
of
instinct.
Absolutely, absolutely, a way to care for each other, so that's what I thought was worth my time growing up, and when I decided to pick a profession. So working at a treatment center where people are trying to regain their life through the grips of addiction, I was able to care for people at their lowest low, and
it was a very emotional experience for you.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. It was very special. And
they liked your food, too.
They liked my food. You know, not a lot of passionate cooks want to work in the private sector because they don't have kids and they want to work in restaurants where it's all flash and bang. So they were very lucky. I was very lucky. It was a perfect mix.
Did you ever make anything like wickedly special for these people?
Oh, all the time. Yeah, I made macarons there, and I made grad cakes and pastries and breakfast.
When they'd finished their course at the center.
Yeah, and breads and everything from scratch, and that was really special for them. So, and special for me. And it was kind of this beautiful moment in time and space where I was able to meet my now partner and the father of my daughter. So it was just meant to be.
It was, yes. Well, serendipity, I've often said on this show and elsewhere that serendipity is the guiding principle of life.
It sure is.
It means we don't know why it happened, but it's beautiful.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Once again, I'll just make sure everybody knows that I'm speaking with Kate Boutillier, who is the owner and basically the core of a new, brand new flake pastry shop in Centinoka Mall. So, Caitlin, you had this new world opening up.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got involved with a program called Launchpreneur.
That's right. Yeah, so Options actually decided to close. And I got an opportunity through a friend who was building a coffee business. He said, "You got to come do this program with me." So I said, "Yeah, sure. That sounds great. It's on Tuesday nights. It's at the college, which is right across from my mom's house. So Harry can go hang out with grandma and I'll educate myself a bit." And that really gave me like the bravery to follow through on wanting to be an entrepreneur. I've always wanted to be an entrepreneur. I've always wanted this end goal of working for myself. Gaining those skills was an investment in myself.
And gave you a great deal of emotional security. You knew you could do things.
Yeah.
You weren't just saying, "Oh, I'd like to do it." You'd say, "I've done it."
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, getting an education from local experts like Jenna from Trilogy Solutions and all the girls and women down at the Seminar Economic Development Center, and professionals from Kamloops and Kelowna on marketing and pricing strategy, social media, and as well as that, going through it with other entrepreneurs was really valuable. And then, of course, there's a little competition in that as well.
Well, you've been doing that for a long time.
Yeah,
you're good at that.
There's an end presentation, mm-hmm. and there's prizes to be won. So
now the Launchpreneur program is fairly unique in that while it's a competition, it's also a very congenial and sort of collaborative effort. And it's a real educational experience as you just described. So even though you didn't win the top prize, you gave the world and yourself a real educational experience.
Yeah.
And frankly, who cares if it comes first? Because in a way, you get out there and the world knows you and you get to know yourself a bit better too.
Honestly, when we were at the final night where we're all making our presentations, we had prepared a 3-minute presentation and a 10-minute presentation. And I think there were about 10 of us that had the 3-minute presentation. And when the judges announced that I was going to be one of the finalists who got to do my 10-minute presentation, I just thought, you know what, even if I don't win, at least I get to go up there and do this. I've prepared. I've spent a lot of time on this presentation, and now I get to speak to my audience. I get to speak to my community.
And they have to listen.
And that's a great opportunity right there. Like, I'm happy with that. That's what I decided while I sat there nervously waiting to go on stage for my 10-minute presentation. And, you know, I was lucky enough to win third place, which gave me a little cash prize and a lot of great contacts, gift certificates to local businesses, accountants, business coaches, website development, Spectrum Signworks gave us our little sandwich board outside of our shop, and it's beautiful. Jenna is kind of working with me on strategy for social media. Sue McCrae, she's giving me just personal advice from woman to woman about motherhood, business. So It's all good. I'm very, very lucky to have gotten the opportunities I got through them.
And it allowed you to think, and in fact, in some ways, it compelled you to think about what do you really want to do? How do you really want to organize a business if you were setting one up?
That's right. I mean, becoming good at something, having a skill like pastry arts or you know, being a pastry chef, that's just one aspect of being an entrepreneur. I mean, it's kind of the base level. You have to have that skill, that proprietary product, or, you know, something that is your specialty. You have to be the expert in your field, so to speak. But then after that, you've got regulatory bodies, and you've got marketing, and you've got accounting, and you've got, you know, construction and WorkSafe BC, and so many different regulatory bodies in every unique field. And that course really helps you navigate it all, because it gives you a place where you can really safely ask questions that you might think are kind of silly, but they're not. And you get like real answers. You're not sifting through mountains of information on the internet.
And they're pragmatic. They're not just fantasies. They're actual things that work.
That's absolutely right.
One of the things that's worked for you is the Zest Food Hub.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the place where you gravitated to after this process. And now you're an anchor tenant.
That's right. Well, you know, I was looking for my own space. And I was not having a lot of luck. There wasn't a lot on the market within the pocket of what we needed and for our price range. And actually, Bill Laird told me, you know, you should go check out Zest. And I thought, no, you know, I don't want to share space. I don't know if I play well with others. And so I was a little reluctant, but barrier after barrier after barrier with finding my own space was kind of getting in the way.
Life was nudging you.
Life was nudging me pretty hard. So I realized that I didn't want to miss the summer, and I didn't want to miss my opportunity, and I didn't want to lose my momentum. So I decided I'm going to do markets. My product doesn't exactly like being outside in the sun, in all of the elements, but I'll find something that works. I can't necessarily do chocolate work. I can't necessarily do mousse cakes. What can I do? What can I do? Oh, the macaron. Nobody's making macarons in town. I love making them. They're filled with delicious Couverture chocolate, local fruit, spirits. Like, you can make them any flavor. So they're very, you know, fun to work with, because you can, you know, I get bored easily. So you can change what you're doing. And then, of course, we added croissants to the menu when we started doing the Saturday morning market. It was perfect because nobody was really selling a good breakfast pastry. So that's how we started. And little by little, we saved up that little bit of profit that we were making. And I, you know, I'm still yet to pay myself. So my share of the pie was also going back into the company. And we were able to equip a kitchen within an anchor tenant space in Zest instead of renting theirs by the hour. So our summer season did that for us, which was amazing.
Gives you a good baseline.
Yeah, absolutely. And now we have some bigger equipment too. I was renting fridge and freezer space from Zest even after we had our kitchen. Now we have our own freezer. We have our own oven. We have our own tables and bowls and whisks and spatulas. It's a girl's dream come true.
You can play all day long yeah. at work.
Yeah. And then the summer was coming to an end, and I was getting to the end of my pregnancy as well, and I was starting to worry, how are we going to keep this business alive in this winter season? And now that we've got this kitchen, you know, that we're paying the lease for. After a Saturday market, I think it was one of our last ones in October, Peter and I went to PJ's restaurant, and we were just eating breakfast, and Florabella, who used to be in the space that I was in the mall, who was moving to a larger space. Congratulations for her. I'm happy to see that. She was moving. And there's this little glass, very small space, but all glass. And I really liked that. And it turns out that it actually used to be a jewelry shop when it first opened. I thought, well, if we take our pastries to the market, we can take our pastries to this space.
You know, you can put some edible jewelry on display.
Well, exactly. That's really what I'm after. So I thought, you know, I'm going to talk to the mall about that lease, that space. And it was available for lease. They were super into it. They wanted us there. So we took on the lease. We renovated it. Rook Construction did the renovations. He was actually one of the contestants in L'Entrepreneur. So that's kind of how we knew each other. He did fantastic, amazing work. I designed it, but he just brought my dream to life. We get compliments on the shop all the time. It is beautiful. I love it. I wish I could be there more often. I'm in my kitchen. But yeah, so now we've got a little working business model.
And you've got a vehicle that takes the goodies from the Zest.
That's right.
To the pastry shop.
That's right.
And displays them.
Yeah, we have a delivery vehicle that keeps everything nice and safe. And I'm fortunate enough that this business model is something that I'm familiar with. So when I worked in Kelowna at a chocolate shop called Carrot Chocolate, amazing, amazing work there. I helped grow Julian's business from his first initial space in the industrial park to a downtown location. And we had a commissary kitchen where his original location was and moved in all of the pastries to the location downtown. And I got to practice carting very delicate pastries
from one place to another
on somebody else's dime, because sometimes they didn't make it there. They didn't make it there.
Well, maybe you ate some of them. Maybe you didn't. Just before we go, we've got about five more minutes. I'd like you to run through starting some macarons and then getting them to their final destination. So just run through the process of making your exquisite macaron, whichever you can pick, whichever flavor or specific type you want. But just so listeners understand the kind of complexity, but also the directness of what you do.
Sure. Well, it all starts with the selection of chocolate and fruit puree or flavoring that you want to use. So right now we have a really delicious dark chocolate and red fruit macaron. So I've chosen an extra bitter dark chocolate. It's a 76% single origin from Madagascar. It's beautiful, silky smooth, but quite bitter, and it's got some acidity to it. And then that's paired with kirsch, which is a cherry liqueur, cherry puree, which we'll be making from local cherries in the summer. And we also add raspberry puree to that as well. So that's where the red fruit comes in. There's actually notes of red fruit in this chocolate already, but the fruit helps bring that out and adjust the texture. So we make that ganache with fruit puree, cream, and the dark chocolate, and we set that to crystallize. So chocolate, when you melt it, it moves from a beta 5 structure of chocolate to a beta 1, and then it recrystallizes as it cools. And so you have to melt it down, mix it with the puree, and then let it sit for 12 to 24 hours. And then when I come back into the kitchen the next morning, I mix my almond flour, which is just a fine ground almond meal, with icing sugar. I make a Swiss meringue. I fold them together. That stage of folding the batter actually has its own name. It's called macronage. And you can overdo it and you can underdo it. So it's quite the art and science of how many times you fold that batter. And this is where like a lot of people mess it up. And cooking your syrup, your elevation comes into question. So you have to have a good thermometer. You have to know where you are in the world, which is hard sometimes. And once you've done all that, you have this beautiful, colorful batter. We color it with cocoa butter. So it's a fat-soluble cocoa butter that has varying colors. Or right now, we're just mixing cocoa powder to make it a nice brown shell. And then you pipe that into little rounds on a silpat, which is a silicone baking mat with fibers within it so it's flexible. And you bake it at a very gentle temperature, size them up, fill them with ganache, and you're done. And if you've done it right, you should have a beautiful crispy shell with a chewy texture on the inside. And that ganache is what gives it the beautiful texture and flavor.
All I can say, Kate, if our listeners aren't getting a little hungry right now, they must have fallen asleep, because as you were describing, the process is rich. Mm-hmm. I mean, the food is rich, but the process is rich as well. And it's clear that you really have in your 14 years come across lots of ideas and absorb them, and they have become part of you. You just, if listeners could see your hands moving, the expression on your face, they'd realize that you're going through the motions of doing it in your mind and even in the space we're in right now. I want to thank you very much, Kate, for coming on our show, for sharing your experiences, and particularly for sharing the kind of combination of nurturing and quality, beautifully prepared food for our listeners. I'm sure there's a lot of people who've been running around looking for Macron in the very near future. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Warren. It was my pleasure.